Since 2015, a legal battle has been playing out on Nauru, a tiny island nation in the Pacific. This case has been described by one judge as a shameful affront to the rule of law. It began when a group of people, including several politicians and the former president of Nauru, are arrested for protesting outside the Nauruan parliament. What follows is the tearing up of an international treaty, a government blacklist, and a tragic death. Today, how the former president and 18 other protesters became Nauru's most wanted.
So in 2015, there was a protest outside the Nauruan parliament.
Helen Davidson is an immigration reporter for The Guardian.
We're talking about a couple of hundred people crammed in around the doors of, you know, the most important building in this country. There's a lot of shouting. It's not a really organised protest. It's kind of a rabble. In the footage that we have seen, there are people being dragged away shirtless. There's a lot of yelling. There doesn't seem to be a lot of cohesion. And in the crowd are a lot of regular Nauruan people. They're very angry. But we also have a lot of really high-level politicians, including a former president. He's now in opposition at this point, but Sprent de Guido is former president of Nauru. We also have Matthew Batsiua, who is a former minister, and he is one of several MPs, including de Guido, who have recently been suspended from parliament. And that's one of the catalysts for this protest.
A former Nauru cabinet minister says the rule of law and democracy have been eroded over the past 6 years by the Wanga Adeyeng government.
Concern regarding the government of Nauru's alleged interference with the judiciary, the suspension of opposition members of parliament, the cancelling of passports of opposition members of parliament, and the removal of civil and political rights.
And what happened in this protest?
So the protest escalated, there were rocks thrown, there were some injuries. It spread out over a neighbouring runway and a flight had to be diverted.
Wow.
After the riot, the police start making arrests and eventually they arrest and charge 19 men and women, including the former president and several former MPs and ministers. This group becomes infamous. They become known as
the so-called Nauru 19.
The Nauru 19.
Which has been facing legal action from the state since their protest.
So let's zoom out for a second on this. How did we get to a situation where members of Nauru's government and former MPs and presidents were protesting outside of parliament?
Nauru is an interesting place. It's a very tiny, tiny Pacific island nation. You could walk around it in about half an hour. It has a really quite potted history, lots of allegations of corruption. There had recently been crackdowns on free speech. They had banned Facebook. There were accusations that the government had interfered in the courts and had sacked or deported some senior judges.
Wow.
After the judges were sacked and deported, five MPs were suspended from parliament and accused of high treason for the simple fact of speaking to the international media about what had happened.
Okay, so there's this protest about corruption with a bunch of people, including some politicians, getting arrested, and then 19 people are prosecuted. What happens next?
So this is where it gets complicated, but essentially what we can split this group into two different groups. Three members of the Nauru 19 plead guilty, and the way that they're treated and the reaction to their pleadings and their court case gives us a really good sense of what's to come for the rest of the group.
How so?
So according to court records, before these men were sentenced, the Justice Minister of Nauru stood up in Parliament and commented on the case. He said, "We are not here to be lenient, that in other countries they would be in jail for a lifetime, and we want to hasten their charges." And he also notes that the presiding judge's contract is up for renewal and that her boss would be watching the outcome of this case closely.
So wait, the judge is on a contract, is that right?
Yeah, so it's pretty common across the Pacific Island nations in particular that judges are contracted in. The legal systems are quite similar and they quite often will sit on benches in different countries.
And what's happened here is that the Justice Minister has commented on the case before it's even finished and reminds the judge that her contract is up soon. Is that right?
That's the way it was received.
That sounds incredibly worrying.
Yes, it does. For a politician, let alone a justice minister, to stand up and make those kinds of representations and drop those kind of hints about a case before the sentence has been delivered, I think would raise eyebrows just about anywhere in the world.
Okay, so what does happen with this case?
So sometime later, despite what has been taken to be quite a lot of pressure put on this presiding judge. She hands down what are seen as pretty moderate sentences.
To her credit, a lot of people have said.
And what actually happened to her, to the magistrate?
Her contract was not renewed. The government then appealed those sentences because they were unhappy with them, and the Supreme Court increased them by up to 700%. But it wasn't over there, because then the three convicted people appealed their sentences to Australia's High Court.
How did they appeal it to Australia's High Court?
So under a bilateral treaty, it's been around for about 45 years between Australia and Nauru. Nauruan cases can go as far as the Australian High Court for an appeal process. It's just part of two countries helping each other out legally, essentially. So their case went to the High Court in Australia, which sent it back to the Supreme Court saying, you know, you guys need to look at this again.
So they wanted Nauru to take another look at that sentence.
Yeah, so that 700% increase had been thrown out, but the case was sent back to Nauru for them to look at again. And they decided that it didn't need to be increased by that much, but that the original sentence was still too low. And so they were still given an increase on that original sentence. Then they appeal again to the Australian High Court. So we're going back to the Australian High Court for a second time. Unbeknownst to almost everyone involved, the Nauruan government has decided to sever the treaty with Australia so that the High Court is no longer somewhere that Nauruan defendants can take their cases.
They decide to sever the treaty that sets up this whole system of appeal where people can go to Australia.
That's right. So the Nauruan government says that it's about costs and resources and their own kind of sovereignty. They want to set up their new court. It just happens to be at the same time that a very politically significant and controversial case is going before the High Court, and they do it without telling anyone so that no one has any time to get alternatives in play.
What do you mean they don't tell anyone?
So in December 2017, the Nauruan government gave the Australian government the 90 days notice that it needs that they are ending the treaty. But no one tells the public, no one tells the defendants, no one tells their lawyers. And so by the time everyone finds out, the 3 months has elapsed and there is no longer any access to the High Court. There's also no access to any Court of Appeal because they haven't set up a replacement yet.
So unbeknownst to the people in the middle of this case, their avenues for appeal are taken away.
That's right.
So what happened to these three men who had pleaded guilty in the end?
So these three men went to jail. Their sentences were less than a year. They were partially suspended, but they were still longer than they were originally expecting to be sentenced for.
And after a really long legal battle, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay, so this sounds like a pretty extraordinary case for those who pleaded guilty. What happened to those that pleaded not guilty?
The others were all charged with various counts of affray, riot, public order offences, and the Nauruan government really wanted to make sure that this trial was seen as fair and just, and so they hired an independent judge. They got advice and they hired an independent judge from Australia.
It was exciting for me to go there for the first time.
And that was Justice Geoffrey Mukey.
The climate was what struck me most of all when I stepped off the plane. It's never less than 30 degrees and never less than about 90% humidity. And it's a very challenging environment.
Justice Geoffrey Mukey is the former Chief Judge of South Australia's District Court. He retired in 2016, but he was well-respected, highly regarded. He's maintained a huge interest and passion in the law. And it's these things that led to him being sort of tapped on the shoulder and asked to come and sit on the bench in Nauru and hear this trial.
Well, the government, when they appointed me, didn't know that I'm a passionate supporter of the rule of law. I'm probably a bit of a rule of law tragic, Stavitson, and have been for many years. So with that background of my passion for the rule of law, it was a bit disconcerting to then be sitting on a court where I could see matters that I took for granted to be ignored.
Justice Mukey starts going through all the case notes and the case history, and he starts to find out what's actually been happening to this group of people in the lead up to the trial.
When I read the pre-trial applications on behalf of the defendants, which set out the fact that they had been denied legal representation by the public legal defender on the island upon the order of the government, and in particular the then Minister for Justice, Mr. David Adiang, who ordered the then public defender not to represent any of those charged with the offences.
So he comes across evidence of a government-operated but unwritten blacklist
to prevent any of the Nauru 19 or their supporters from work and paid employment.
They're stopped from renting their houses out. They're stopped from getting jobs. There are changes made to whether they can run for parliament again. There's just an extraordinary list of things that were done to make life incredibly difficult for this group of people. They weren't able to find jobs or gain an income. And Nauru is a very small island. It's a very small economy. And so to give you an example, one member of the Nauru 19 sought to rent out his house to visiting doctors from Medecins Sans Frontières, who were there to look after Nauruan and refugee patients. And MSF were told that they were not allowed to live in that house, that if they were going to continue to have a rental agreement with one of the members of the Nauru 19, they would be kicked out of the country. And lastly, it's alleged that they were even denied medical treatment, which they needed.
There was an oral application made on behalf of Mr. Sprint Dabwido, one of the Nauru 19.
Sprint Dabwido, the former president at this time, was suffering from cancer.
To vary his bail to allow him to retrieve his passport and leave the island to seek life-saving treatment for a squamous cell carcinoma of the larynx. That application was opposed by the DPP. I granted it after hearing some evidence about what his doctors had advised him and the fact that there was no treatment that he required available on the island. I later heard that he was denied the return of his passport for several weeks. When he got to where he was going to have this treatment, his bank accounts were frozen. He had no money, so he sought refugee status in Australia and was sent to a hospital in Armidale, New South Wales, where he was advised that his tumours had metastasised. They could not be treated. He proposed to his long-term partner in the cafe of the hospital. They were married in Sydney, and he died a couple of weeks later. After that, I read that the government wished Mr. Dabwido well. They'd had supported his moving from the island to get life-saving treatment. And I thought to myself, well, if opposing bail, a variation of bail to allow that to happen, is supporting him getting treatment, I have a different idea of support than they do.
Next, the fight for a fair trial continues. So Miyuki's basically found all this mistreatment of the Nauru 19. They've been denied proper legal representation, the justice minister has been weighing in, and they've been living under these really intense restrictions. What about Miyuki? Did he himself feel pressured by the government?
Well, yes, Miyuki himself also received a lot of pressure. So before he delivered his judgment, the justice minister stood up in parliament and said that...
I just want to inform our people that we are not going to pay a dollar.
A previous order that they had to pay the legal costs of the defendants was never going to happen. They said they were not going to be paying anything...
to any white-eared lawyers from Australia.
So white-eared Australian lawyers, that's sort of a Nauruan term of phrase talking about white Australians coming in and making money in Nauru. He also says that, you know, we are going to get these people convicted
and locked up for the longest term possible, and then we'll sue them and use the money that we get to better the lives of good Nauruans.
And then he also specifically mentions the judge, and he says...
But first, we have to deal with Justice Miyuki. Now, you could have taken that a number of ways, but I was told by some expats on the island that that didn't sound too good for me. So I went in ultimately with some apprehension.
So what did Miyuki decide to do with this case?
He ordered a permanent stay of prosecution. He said there can be no trial. He said this is where the prosecution of this group of people ends because of everything that I've laid out here and everything I've seen. There is no way they can receive a fair trial, so it can't go ahead, let them go.
And what happened to Miyuki in the end?
3 days after his ruling, Miyuki's contract was terminated and he was not welcome back in Nauru.
Okay, so where did the case go from there? Was that the end of it?
That was not the end of it. The Nauruan government had absolutely no intention of giving up its prosecution of the demonstrators. And as I mentioned earlier, the Nauruan government had torn up that treaty with Australia, which had taken away the High Court as the final avenue for appeals. By this time, they've set up a replacement. Nauru now has its own Court of Appeal. So that's where it sends Miyuki's decision. And this newly created Court of Appeal says, actually, you know what? Miyuki was wrong. The trial can go ahead. And they set the trial date for December 2019.
How is this group feeling in the lead up to this, to their prospects of a fair trial?
People are really nervous about this trial. After the last 4.5 years, there's very little trust left in the system. They have gone into this trial knowing that the defendants are going to be found guilty. They are not expecting anything less. They're just hoping that the sentences are not the maximum, because one of the charges that at least one person was looking at is a life sentence with hard labour. So they're facing really serious time, and 3 of the defendants are actually so scared that before the trial starts, they flee the country.
And is there much attention on the cases of these men leading into this retrial? I mean, is Australia paying attention? Are international journalists paying attention?
There's not a lot of people looking at this. Australia isn't giving its approval of what's happening, but it isn't giving its disapproval either, at least not publicly. So what we found out during the trial or in the period just before the trial was that Australia, through the Department of Foreign Affairs, had been making representations to the Nauruan government, you know, reiterating the importance of the rule of law and respect for the rule of law and the court system and that sort of thing, like very diplomatic language to sort of urge Nauru into giving these guys a fair trial. But publicly, they're saying nothing.
Okay, so the court date comes around. What happens?
So the trial starts and it's before a new judge who's been brought in from Fiji, Justice Daniel Fatiaki. He's a former Chief Justice in Fiji. Now, he's received another application to stay the trial. They're asking him to make the same decision that Miyuki made. But he doesn't. He rejects the application for another permanent stay, and he also rejects another application for a government-funded legal defence.
So what are they left with in terms of legal representation?
They're left with essentially one public defender, and this public defender is brought in at the last minute. He tells the court that he doesn't feel he's adequately prepared or resourced to represent 15 people, but Fatiaki says it has to go ahead anyway. He orders the trial to continue. Mm. The hearing goes for several days. It gets quite heated at points. Towards the end of the trial, Matthew Batsiua, who is the lead defendant, he's that former minister, stands up and delivers a statement to the court.
What does he say?
In January 2014, the Nauru government removed the entire judiciary of the country. Next, they removed the opposition from parliament indefinitely. Only some people protested that. Us, the Nauru 19. We stood up for the constitution. We stood up for the rule of law, we stood up for democracy, and we protested. Since then, we have been persecuted. We have been blocked from exercising our rights in our homeland by our own government. Because the government won't fund our defence, we have been unable to participate in this trial in any meaningful sense. We are not guilty, and we maintain our pleas in respect of each and every charge against us on the indictment. If we are found guilty by this court, we are certain that history will absolve the Nauru 19.
And what happened in the end with the case?
A few days before Christmas, Judge Daniel Fatiaki finds all members of the group guilty of various charges. They're acquitted of some, but on the whole, they are all found guilty. And a few days later, they're all sentenced to jail terms.
How big are those jail terms?
Some of them were facing life, but the longest that was given out was 18 months, and that was to Matthew Batsua. But many of them received discounted sentences, in part because some of them were minors at the time of the offences, but also because Judge Fatiaki recognised the level of persecution that had been meted out against this group. So Matthew Batsua, he was sentenced to 18 months for riot, but he received a seven-month discount on that sentence because one of the delay in getting to trial, in part because of having to set up a whole new court to retry them, his own personal circumstances, and also because of the extrajudicial punishment, which was specifically the government-operated blacklist against the group.
Out of all of the Nauru 19, where are they now? What's going on with them right now?
The three who pled guilty have served their sentences and they're out. Two of them are still in Nauru. One of them has since come to Australia to seek asylum. Of the 16 who pleaded not guilty, 12 are in jail. Three have sought asylum either in Australia or elsewhere. And as we know, the former president, Brent de Guido, has died.
What do we know about the lives of those in jail?
We don't know much. They are in a newly built facility that was at least partly Australian funded and informally recognised by pretty much everyone involved in this case as having been built specifically to jail the Nauru 19.
They're in a specifically built jail funded by Australia.
That's the accusation.
What does Nauru say about this case and the narrative around it?
After the sentence, the Nauruan government released a statement saying that the Republic has always respected the decisions of the court and would have done so irrespective of the outcome.
Australia has come up a lot in this story. There's an Australian judge. There's allegations that the prison these men have been kept in was partly funded by Australia. There's been entreaties by the government. Should Australia have done more to help the Nauru 19?
Australia absolutely could have done more. But the thing to note is that Australia and Nauru have a very complicated and very codependent relationship, which is largely built around the asylum seeker offshore processing system. But the two countries need each other. My analysis is that the Nauruan government knows it can push the envelope. And the Australian government, despite really holding the cards, they are pretty reluctant to publicly hit out at one of their closest allies. But we should care. We should care about democracy in the Pacific. The Pacific community is very tight, and democracy and justice and the rule of law is important for obvious reasons. And what's been done to that in Nauru in this case is something that should really be raising a lot of red flags, not just in Australia, but in the entire region. And very few flags have been raised.
That's it for today. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to the show. Just search for Full Story on whatever app you get your podcasts on. We'd also love to hear what you think about the podcast. So if you're on an app that has ratings and reviews, let us know. Thanks to Helen Davidson for her time. You can read her reporting on immigration and the Nauru 19 at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Joe Koning and Ellen Leibeater, and our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. Okay, catch you Wednesday.